Mr. Monty Panesar.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast. We look forward to it.
Let's rewind to the beginning.
I'm born in England. I used to watch Grange Hill, Biker Grove, right? My dad said, look, you're getting a bit bodgy now. I'm having far too many curries. That's how I gradually got into cricket. Then I went to Bedford Modern School for trials. Next thing you know, we got a letter back saying you've been selected for Bedford Under 12s. And then quickly things accelerated. This is where I'm thinking I've got to start taking it seriously. A lot of people said to me, they go, Monty, you were like a Rolls Royce, poetry in motion. I played my first class game at the age of 18. I'm nervous. Wreck. These heroes are just playing FIFA like it's only a game tomorrow. It's not that important.
That was my cricket experience.
Matt's great to have on our side. He brings all the sweets. I really enjoy journalism. I did a master's in sports journalism. My lecturer saying to me, so he goes, Monty, why are you studying this course? I said, I want to become the Brown Pierce Morgan of journalism. I'm still waiting to become that. Even my family felt that something isn't right with Monty. At that time, I fell out of love with cricket. I didn't realise.
Guys, Matt Haycock's here. Welcome to the Matt Haycock Show, where today we've had a few sporting guests over the years, but we've never had a cricketer. So I'm very pleased to welcome an icon of British cricket, a guy who was made friends and fans around the world on and off the pitch, Mr. Monty Panesar.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on your podcast. I'm really looking forward to it.
Well, you were telling me that you got your own podcast as well, so I feel a bit of pressure that I'm going to be under the microscope as a host.
No, if you're all right, I'll get you on my one. I'm someone who's been extremely successful as a businessman, and now you live in Dubai. I don't think I haven't had a guest like that on my podcast.
No, oh, thank you. you're already repaying the complimentary introduction. Well, look, let's rewind to the beginning. I always like to rewind to the beginning with my guests and understand, how the current, exciting life started. I mean, where were you born? What were you like as a kid? Was cricket always in the blood?
Yeah, like I was born from Luton Dunstable Hospital. My dad used to play cricket, on a Saturday. Just for fun, played in a league, Luton Tack College. That's where they played initially. And then my dad's best friend, who worked at the Vauxhall plant, because at that time, people who came in the 60s and 70s, they'll go to areas where there's work. And he obviously went to Luton, used to work at the Vauxhall factory at the time. And his best mate, Hithu Nayak, was a cricket coach, and he loved it. And I remember going on Saturdays, do the bit of scoring while my dad, hit a few runs and get a few wickets. And that's how I gradually got into cricket. So I used to go on a Saturday as an 8-9-year-old, and just do the scoring.
Had you picked up a bat at this point?
No, then I got a bat when I was on my 10th birthday, a Centurion cricket bat.
I remember the Centurion from school.
Yeah, exactly.
You just sit there with your ball, didn't you? Tapping away to make it strong.
Yeah. And I put linseed oil on it, so the wood dries the heat and make it better. And so that's when I got my first cricket bat from my coach, obviously Hithu Nayak. At the time, and his dream was to I've got a group of youngsters, Sunday morning practice used to go there. My dad said, look, you're getting a bit, getting a bit podgy now, for a healthy 10-year-old and, having far too many curries, you're enjoying your food. Why don't you just go morning practice just to lose a bit of weight? I used to hate it, doing a couple of laps.
Do you lose much weight at cricket? I mean, I never look at cricketers and think of them as stellar examples of fitness.
Not really. Not back in them days, 20 years ago. The game was still very much amateur. You just go and play cricket. And then it was all about the skill of cricket rather than the professionalism of diet and lifestyle and everything like
that.
When
you say the skill of cricket, so we talk about how to hit a bat, how to bowl a ball.
So you could be overweight, but if your skill as a spinner is really good, if your skill as a fast bowler or swinging the ball, or your skill as a batsman, you can strike the ball well. Coaches sometimes just think, it's okay, let's just get the best out of this guy who has difficult to make lifestyle choices and be really fit. Because look at football, rugby, it's a much more of a physical sport. Yeah. So you've got to be, your fitness is part of your, skill. But in cricket, you can get away with it. It's like darts player, They have so many pints, but they still nail the darts, don't they? It's the same thing in cricket.
Can you still get away with it as much nowadays, or has everything moved on to a level of fitness?
Yeah, I think the game's gone a lot more quicker now. So I think if you want to make it at international level, then you've got to get a little bit more fitter. You've got to at least try and,
run faster between wickets.
Yeah, run faster. Try and show that your lifestyle choices you know, once you're out, away from the game, you know, you're not going McDonald's or, you know, Burger King. You're like thinking, now I'm going for the healthy option.
No more naan breads, no more cheesy garlic naans.
Exactly, no more cheesy garlic naans with, you know, some hot curry, and then you got the dessert afterwards. You know, the little things like that. I think coaches now, you know, they definitely look at you. They think, you know, is he having the sugary drink? Is he going for that? Just small things like that. And the cricketers who just don't make that 1%, you know, that's the 1% difference. If you make that choice and think, actually, I'm not going to have the stuffy, you know, chocolate pudding or anything like that. I'm not going to have any of that. And I'm going to just, you know, make that choice. They're the ones who kind of like, you know, the coaches invest more time in them. They'll just think, yeah, they've got the attitude. They've got the desire. They've got the motivation. And the guys who are skillful, but slightly overweight and rather have a bag of crisps, you know, sensations and a chocolate and watch Netflix and not do that extra session, for example, after the game, just do another 20-minute run or anything like that, then they get left behind. And the other guys, and there's so much money in the game now, and the guys are making over a million pounds a year, so many of them now, you know, multi-million pounds. And used to be only, I think at the time, Kevin Peterson, Andrew Flintoff kind of started that trend where they were earning big, big money. And now it's a lot more cricketers earning that.
Well, let's get into that shortly. Let's rewind to you know, 10, 11 years old. You're podgy. You've got your first bat. What happened?
Well, then I was trying to be a batsman. But just
for fun at this point.
Yeah, yeah. This was just, you know, a passion, really. And then, you know, my club, Luton Town and Indians at the time, was called Luton Indians, right? And we used to play at a sort of Lancaster Avenue, which was like a pitch that we hired from the council, got the lease. Nice ground, you know, not bad. But on that road, David Pleat used to live in a big bungalow. And he was a manager of Luton Town at the time. So my coach, Hiddu Naik, pick us up in his Vauxhall Estate Astra. And we used to all go in our little kit bags. But as we drove by, he goes, you know what? That's David Pleat there. He lives there. So recently now, when they got promoted, Luton Town, into the Premiership, was probably the biggest story, you know, since I've, you know, played international cricket for England coming out of Luton, right? Luton always gets, you know, maybe not the best stories, let's be honest, you know, not the best sort of stories that come out of Luton. apart from people who love going to, you know, holiday to Ibiza and they'll go to Luton Airport. I'm sure you've been to Luton Airport, right?
I've been to Luton Airport,
yeah. You seem like a guy who's been to Spain a few times.
On those EasyJet flights.
Yeah, exactly. That's the only reason people say Luton's good for is to get on the EasyJet flight.
Isn't Kate Moss from Luton? Wasn't she a Luton export?
Yeah, yeah, I think she was. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Only two things I remember of Luton.
Exactly. Well, now three. Monty Panesar.
Exactly.
And four is Luton Town people playing in the Premiership. I can see you could be a Hatters fan. Well, we'll get you a Luton Town T-shirt.
I'll tell you my cricket story in a minute.
Yeah, and but the ground isn't obviously, you know, that great at the moment. Only 10,000 there. So obviously going back to David Pleat. So when I saw him at the Royal Suite, he remembered. He goes, Monty, I remember you as a 12-year-old going to Lancaster Avenue and bowling on that stump. And I thought, who's this young cricketer? He's there all day, just training and did nothing else. But then, you know, I never thought I'll make it as a cricketer. I just thought it's a nice little thing. You know, I've got something I love. I'm beginning to love cricket, you know. Initially,
I
didn't.
What did you think you wanted to do? Were you any good at school? What did you think?
Like you always think, you know, I want to be a doctor, a lawyer, you know, accountant. My parents always said, you know, make sure you get good education. I don't want you to be, you know, grafting like us. We're like, you know, going to the factories and just working so hard. So, you know, your guys' lives are better when you get older. And that they always pride that. They always said, look, we want you to be getting really good jobs. That'll make us very proud.
How many brothers and sisters?
I've got a younger brother, younger sister. Okay. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, there, you know, David Pleat, obviously connection. So when Luton got promoted, it was a nice little, you know, story for us to think, well, here was a 12-year-old playing cricket. That was David Pleat then. And now we were together at the Royal Suite at Wembley and seeing Luton get promoted, it was a very special feeling. And then, you know, when I, as a 12-year-old, you know, playing cricket, I ended up becoming a left-arm seamer. And then I went to Bedford Modern School for trials for Bedfordshire under-12s. And we just went there and went for trials. And then next thing you know, we got a letter back saying you've been selected for Bedfordshire under-12s. And my coach, Hiddu Naik, he was so, so happy. you know, there's a few of us in that team that, you know, another guy, you know, three, four of us, you know, in that team were in there. Like Ankur Desai was another one who's now works on BBC Asia Network, you know, as a radio presenter. So we all play cricket together. There's a few of my other friends, you know, Hemal Randerwala was there, Deepesh Patel. You probably know none of them, but just they're my friends at the time, right? And so, you know, that was my start of my journey.
Why is it very Indian?
Because it's a national sport in India. So I remember the Tebbit test when I played for England, you know, said to me, look, why is it that people who live in England, born in England, or people who've come from other nations like Brazil, Germany, work in England, won't support, let's say, the national football team, but they'll support Germany and Brazil. Or people from India who work in England now, they'll support the India cricket team, but they won't support England. He said, that's wrong. He wants people who live in England support England, you know. But then I think it's easy for me because I'm born in England, born, you know, I was born at Luton and Knutsford Hospital, which is still there. I used to watch Grange Hill, Biker Grove, right? Grew up watching Thundercats, Alvin and the Chipmunks,
yeah,
right? Rugrats, gosh, I bet you remember all this stuff,
I do,
right?
I do.
I used to watch that Saturday mornings, you know,
or Scooby Doo.
You know, I mean, all of these kind of things. So I'm basically born and bred in this country. So it's easy for me then, you know, when you're culturally, you know, in this country, go to primary school, go to secondary school, your interests are very British, you're going to be supporting England and everything, right?
But from a cricket perspective, because even though you're born and raised in England, you grew up in an Indian family, you know, with it that's on the telly, and you know, I guess an Indian family's watching it on TV. It's their thing. It's just like a natural, almost like hereditary thing that the Indians pick it up.
Yeah, because it's a national sport at the time, and you know, cricket. You look at India. India was a country where, let's be honest, there was only one guy. Who kind of in the 90s, India was a developing nation, you know, that's why a lot of people, you know, in the 60s came to England for a better quality of life. And then India needed something, needed a motivation, needed some sort of growth, needed something to look up to. And it was only one guy, Sachin Tendulkar, who was probably, you know, he's the greatest sportsman, you know, one of the greatest cricketers, probably one of the greatest sportsmen ever, in my opinion. And in the 90s, everyone used to just worship this guy, you know. I call another sportsman that maybe come close to him could be like Pele, you know, Brazil at the time, Maradona for Argentina.
Were all your cricket heroes as a kid Indian, or did you have any English ones? Because I was going to say the, you know, with similar age bracket, well, same age bracket.
And yeah.
I remember, like, as a kid, I'd be watching A Question of Sport or something. It'd be like, you know, Ian Botham's and Mike Gatting's and those kind of people. I mean, were they sporting heroes?
Yeah. Like my, I remember my dad used to film Test cricket on the little cassette players, and then I used to watch them. So I used to watch like David Gower.
Yep.
You know, bat against Pakistan. I remember Graham Gooch score a triple century at Lord's against India. I remember Andrew Craddock, you know, getting, you know, bowling, and Dominic Cork, he got a hat trick against the West Indies. This is when I was watching in the 90s on the ramp. Rampakash used to get to 30 and then get out, you know, never used to go past that. Then he took an amazing one handed catch backward point at Lord's. So as I was growing up, I remember my dad giving me a little book, which was MCC book forward by Tony Lewis. And in there, it was like I was reading through it all. And then suddenly there was like a guy called Bishan Bedi, right, who used to play for Northants, and he played for India at the time. But then when I was growing up, I wanted to be a left-arm seamer. So as a 12-year-old, I wanted to be a fast bowler. And when I got to 15, Paul Taylor, who used to play for Northants, and said to me, Monty, I don't think you're going to become a fast bowler. You just haven't got the pace, the natural athleticism. Try spin bowling. So this was when I was 15, playing for Bedfordshire under 15s. And then I tried spin bowling and the ball just turned and bounced, had long fingers. He goes, you've got big shoulders. Try that. Then I bowled it again. And he goes, next game, go and bowl left arm spin and let's see how it goes. So Hitu Nayak, my coach at the time, his dream is I want one cricketer to play for England. And that was his dream. And suddenly he's saying part of that dream is like, wow, to get him to England, we got to change. Bowl left, dump spin. So I got, so my mom, my parents had a Vauxhall Carlton at the time, maroon colour, saloon as it, I remember it. You know, it was a brown, nice brown interior, really big car. I sat at the back and they took me to Royal Grammar School at Worcester. And in Predigan's Worcester under 15s. And I took 7 for 35. And then I come home and then I told Paul Taylor, Tony Pemberthy, there was a coach as well for, you know, Bedfordshire under 15s. And he goes, yeah, stick to left arm spin. And then quickly things accelerated after that.
So how old are you, sorry, at this point?
15.
15, okay.
And then got to 16, played Bedfordshire Minor Counties cricket. So I'm playing men's cricket now. I'm the youngest guy at the age of 16 to play for Bedfordshire Minor Counties.
And at this point, are you now thinking this could be my future? This could be a career?
Well, this is where I'm thinking I've got to start taking it seriously now because, you know, I'm definitely going up the ranks. Northants started to look at me. Essex at the time wanted a trial, went to Essex. And John Charles was a left-arm spinner. So, you know, was quite fortunate. The teams that were looking at me, their head coaches or second team coaches were spinners. So they're going to be a little bit biased, aren't they? They're going to like, yeah, I want to give him a go. I want to see if we can get another spinner in, you know?
And tell me, I mean, this is obviously showing my utter lack of any kind of cricket knowledge. Yeah. So when we talk about a team, you mentioned Essex.
Yeah.
So a team like Essex, is this professional?
Yeah, yeah, professional county. So we have
and
like
it's all pay. And is that the full time job for the cricket guys at that level?
Yeah, yeah, it's a full time job at the time. So everyone's, you know, doing this as a full time job.
Okay.
Yeah. So I had John Chad, then I had Nick Cook, who played for England, was a left arm spinner at Northants, and John Embry was a coach who played, you know, who played over 60 Test matches for England. So then, you know, people around me, surroundings, I've got like people, coaches who are spinners. You could have a head coach who's a batter, head coach who's a fast bowler or a wicketkeeper. But we actually, I was lucky. And I reckon they pushed me a bit more because I had spin coaches around me. Do you know what I mean? They were like, probably, you know, the coaches are probably thinking, here's a young, talented cricketer. I get him under my ranks. I'm 5 years in the job, innit? So I've got another 5 years as a coach because part of coaches, what they do is they also bring in certain cricketers. So it becomes their project and they can last longer as a coach when they have to then, you know, speak to the chairman and the committee. Oh, yeah, I'm bringing in these youngsters. So I'm bringing in another spinner. So, I'm, you know, obviously they're good coaches, but, you know, that I think that's probably, you know, helped me as well a lot. So that was it really. And then I used to always be a self, you know, I never had massive confidence in myself. I used to always ask the question to the batters, to the coaches, is it good? Is it good enough? Is my action good enough? And a lot of people said to me, they go, Monty, you were like Rolls Royce, you know, red carpet. When you see a Rolls Royce turn up or when you roll a carpet, it's just poetry in motion. He goes, your action was poetry in motion. It was just beautiful to watch, just a beautiful left arm spinner. And he goes, you just had everything, you know, but I just wasn't so confident as a youngster.
And so when did full-time professional cricket start for you then?
Yeah, so then at the age of 17, right. You know, I started as a professional cricketer and then started to play, you know, played for England under 19s. And then after under 19s England, I played my first class game at the age of 18 then against Leicestershire. Took 4 for 11 in the second innings. You know, I was thinking, well, I'm doing really well. Then went to play an under-19s game to Durham against the West Indies at the time. And, I was very much, you know, talked about then.
And you say you played under-19s for England. When did you play in the senior? That was 2006. That was your first English game.
Yeah, yeah.
How old were you then? 24, 25?
23, right. 2006. Okay. Yeah.
And so you'd obviously been playing for a while then. You've made a good name for yourself at the local level.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. At the local domestic level, I played. And then in the Sun newspaper, there was like 5 sportsmen to look out for, Millennium Kids for the Future. I was one of them.
Okay. The only cricketer?
Yeah. There's one cricketer, athlete, netball. I think out of the box, out of all of them, I think I'm the one who only made it to the top.
So when you played that first England game, well, first as a senior in 2006, who were some of your peers? I mean, I presume it would be names that even someone as crap at cricket as me had known nowadays.
Yeah, so like the likes of Andrew Flintoff.
Yeah.
You know, Freddie, yeah. Kevin Peterson, Heard of that, Michael Vaughan.
And did you know people like this from a domestic level from playing before then? Or was it, were these almost like heroes for you to look up to when you got to play next to them?
Yeah, they were heroes to look up to because 2005 Ashes was the turnaround for English cricket. And that's probably, a lot of people say, one of the greatest, you know, Ashes of all time and the greatest series. And it was just unbelievable, you know. And then suddenly I'm like 2006, I'm actually training with them because of the tour to India we got. And there's Freddie just at Loughborough Centre, you know, turning up with his, you know, light blue socks on, Man City socks on, and you know, these big, tall guys. Like, I felt like I was like the small guy. And it was just like surreal for me. It's like, I'm watching these guys on TV and now, and they got like really sort of strong voices as well. It was just, it was a great feeling for me.
And how did you feel, you know, walking onto the pitch for the first time, as in for the first time in that England game? I mean, were you scared? Were you excited?
Yeah, look, I remember the night before when Freddie announced the team he was a captain at 2006 in Nagpur. And he goes, number 11, it put me down. And then I was like, wow, I'm going to be playing tomorrow. And then I thought, are you sure about this? Or am I going to be 12th man? And he goes, no, you're playing tomorrow. I was like, but this is Sachin Tendulkar, Mohammed Kaif, you know, Saurav Ganguly playing, Irfan Pathan, Mohammed Kaif, Wasim Jaffa. These are like great cricketers. I'm not sure if I'm ready for this. Do you know what I mean? So I then went running in my room, wrote down the field setting, because I remember at the time, Darren Lehman said to me when I was in Australia, this was 2005 in Christmas, that when you're in India, if you do get selected to go to India, make sure you write down everything in terms of the field settings the night before. Give it to the captain because it's so noisy. It's like being in a nightclub with so much noise and you're in a stadium. You can't hear anything. It's hand signals. You know, go there, look at the captain all the time. So I thought, if I mentally give him these sheets of paper, he'll look at it, he'll know what field setting I want. Then that's like, saves me half the trouble now. I can focus on my bowling. So I go to his room, and there's Freddie and Steve Harmison, Jimmy Anderson playing FIFA. He's like, yeah, come on, mate. And I was like thinking, you know, this. He goes, oh, you got the field setting. Yeah, this is the field setting. And for tomorrow, I said, oh, brilliant. And then I'm like thinking, like, I'm nervous wreck. I'm like thinking, I'm so nervous. I'm thinking about, am I ready to play? I don't know if I'm ready to play tomorrow or not. All of these, you know, self-doubt thoughts are coming into my mind. And there, these heroes are just, you know, playing FIFA. Like, it's like, it's only a game tomorrow. It's not that important. And then I soon begin to realize that this is how sportsmen at international level behave. They're like, they switch off. They know when to switch off. Get on the field, they know how to switch on.
But is that because they know how to do it, and presumably you know, within whether it's games or months or years, you know, you got to that same level of chilling with FIFA before the game as well, in the same way that, I don't know, if I'm coming on to host a podcast, I don't give it a second thought, whereas someone who's never done it's going to be having sleepless nights or whatever it may be. It's just purely repetition and confidence.
Yeah, that's what it is. So they've obviously played for so long, and for them, it's just like you said, you know, reputation, confidence. And they just think, yeah, it's another game, England. Yeah, once we get on the field, you know, we'll switch on then. And that's a bit, when I was around the 2005 Ashes heroes and all of them, I realised how to switch on and off. You know, like someone said to me, you can't just hold a stiff fist all day long. You're going to be drained. You've got to learn to switch off. But when you're on the field, that's when you get switched on and, you know, you switch off. So that's the kind of stuff I began to learn, right? You don't have to think about cricket all the time, 24/7. You've got to switch it off. And, you know, but I remember when I used to play for Northlands, all I used to ask everyone is, oh, what is it like bowling against Sachin Tendulkar? What is that like? You know, he's the greatest. And everyone would be like, yeah, I haven't bowled against him, but he's, you know, he's larger than figure and everything like that. And that's all I used to ask. And then I remember when I was India at Nagpur, I'm bowling to Sachin Tendulkar now. I'm like, I've always fantasized about bowling to him. And now I'm bowling, you know, to him. And I couldn't believe it at the time. And I thought,
did it live up to the fantasy? Was it scary by that point? Or
playing India in India is very like scary and daunting, because when you're training, When you walk out to train, there's like 10,000 people still watching you train. So it's like, you know, it's the closest feeling of like Messi and Ronaldo when they just when they're training, there's 10,000-20,000 people watching them train. And when we go out to train, it's like no noise. It's like, oh yeah, no one knows them. Every player that goes out, the Indian player, it'll be a big noise. And suddenly you notice Tendulkar because it's the biggest noise when they come out to practice. And when he comes out to bat, the noise is unbelievable. You're like thinking, this is what a superstar looks like. This is what it is to be a superstar. And I couldn't believe it. And then I'm like, you know, bowling, get back on top of my mark. I remember train tracks, you know, keep tight, get over my front leg, make sure I pitch it up forward, get him on the front foot, bowl good deliveries. And then next thing I know, I've got my fuel setting right. Freddie, everyone's got all that right. And I'm just bowling to him. And I'm absolutely loving it. I'm thinking, yeah, just he's going to do that. He hasn't gone after me. He's just batting his way. He's not giving any sort of clues. He was very calm. He's like, it feels like he's in a meditative state. The way he gives body language is calm. He doesn't give anything away. You don't know when he's coming after you. He's probably analysing what to do. Next thing you know, I've hit him on the pad. I can't see the stumps. I start appealing, naturally, as you do. Alimdar, who was an umpire at the time, he gave it out. And off I went like a rocket to point and just celebrated like it was the best thing in the world, hugging my teammates, just exploding with energy. I was like, my first test wicket, I have got the greatest player out ever who I used to fantasize, watch him all the time, ask every cricketer, what is it like, you know, playing against Sachin Tendulkar? And I've got him as my first test wicket. I couldn't believe it. I was like, this is heaven. I can retire now.
But I mean, when you're telling me this story now, I mean, you know, you're telling this with a level of excitement that I would imagine, you know, a kid telling their parents about, you know, their first football game or something at school. I mean, like I said, I've never had a cricketer on before, but I've interviewed plenty of footballers, rugby people, etc. And when they tell their historical stories, it's telling a story like they're telling me what they had for lunch, you know. But I mean, you seem to be so excited about it. I mean, do you still, is it this one particular memory, or are you that passionate about the game still and all these individual moments?
Yeah, look, I still love the game. Yeah, I love the game. I still love, but there's individual moments that give you that hikes, you know, where you just think, what a moment that was. And as I'm going through it now, I'm feeling very excited. You're bringing out the excitement in me because that's how I felt, you know. I was, do you know what I mean? And I just loved it. So for me, it was just, it was an unbelievable feeling, honestly. I just loved it. And it put me into stardom straight away. Off I went like a fire rocket.
That rocketed your career?
Yeah, that was it. I was in, you know, it's like beating Tiger Woods.
And how old were you
at the US
point?
Open?
So how far after your debut is this?
2006 March.
It was on your first year?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, first year when I was in the squad, he picked me straight away. So sometimes you have to thank the people like Andrew Flintoff, you know, he backed me. He goes, yeah, I'll back this guy. There's something about him. He works hard. He's got something. I'll pick him. And next thing, and I've got one of the greatest moments in my life, which then put my name into big stardom.
And how did that then change your domestic thinking? I mean, I don't understand particularly how it works between different clubs, you know. I mean, are there different leagues, different levels? How does the money work? You know, do you get transferred or do you tend to play for a club for life? How does it all work?
Yeah, so then I was obviously owned, I had a contract with Norfans. They paid my wages, but then I was on a central contract. I immediately was on England contract. So then they were paying my wages.
So you get paid to play for England? Because in like football and stuff, you don't get paid for your country, do you?
I don't know if they get paid, but they don't need to get paid when you've got like three or four million.
100 quids or whatever.
It's doing it for the glory. Yeah. But when you play for England, yeah, you get a match fees and then you get a central contract and then it becomes very professional.
So then do you stop them playing for Northants or whatever team you'd be playing for before?
Only when I'm available. England comes first.
Oh, so it's not like, and obviously I'm showing my absolutely horrendous sporting knowledge here, but like if you're playing football, you know, your time to play for your country is at a particular time, so you've still got all the rest of the time of the year to play for your club. If you're playing cricket for your country, that takes so much time, does it, that you don't even really get time to play locally anymore?
Well, I think, what it is, England games come first, and then in between, if it's a local, if you can play for your domestic side, then you go and play. But at the start of the season, like April, you play a few games. And then May, June, July is when the international season starts with England. So you play all of them games. And then in between, if you need a top up in your form, or if you're not bowling so well, let's say for England, then you end up playing more domestic games. But if you're doing well, then you don't need to play. So it's all performance related.
And what about playing outside of the country and stuff? Because I mean, did you only play for England, or did you ever go and play for any other countries, any other teams?
No, I didn't play any other teams. You know, I could have done. You know, like you often do. Like if you try and work in another country for so many years, you can qualify and then play for another country.
Right.
But I never did that. I think playing for England was a huge honour for me. And I stuck to, you know, my loyalty.
Tell me, I won't pretend to remember these moments myself, but in my cricketing research, I'm told that 2012 was a big time for you and Graham Swain, making history in Mumbai as the Dust Devils.
Yeah, yeah, that was the first time we won in 27 years in India.
First time England won against India in...
Yeah, 27 years. So that's, yeah, we're probably... Northants used to be a turning pitch, and me and Swanee played together a lot at Northants. So because we played a lot, when we played in Mumbai, it was a turning pitch. It felt like we was at Northants playing, but we're playing for England now. And we just, it felt very natural to just get the wickets, get, you know, and then get England to victory.
Other than that wicket you told me about a minute ago, any other particular wickets or particular games or moments that really stand out?
Yeah, but maybe, you know, when we won the Ashes in Australia, on Australian soil, back in, I think, 2011, that was a big moment. You know, that was never done for a long time. And, you know, special moments like that, when you sit together and you're just going through the great moments amongst everyone, yeah, that was a special moment.
You spoke a minute ago about you know, about the boys playing FIFA, you know, before the game, and that you know, you couldn't get your head around it because you weren't relaxing. It was your first game, but now you, I guess, have the experience, have the confidence, have the skills. Do you still find you need to mentally prepare for games, or is it just part of the day to day life of being a professional sportsman that there's no individual work required?
Yeah, I think now it's about getting my body, you know, mobile and fit, and because the muscle memory is already there now. So when I'm playing like these, you know, leagues around the world, I was in Miami a couple of weeks playing in the US T10 Masters, then we got the Legends League that's in India happening, and we've got these different, you know, leagues which are happening. So when I play in them sort of games, it's just getting my body fit, mobile and everything. And the muscle memory is there. I've done it. I think I bowled about 30,000, 40,000 deliveries. So it's just muscle. It's just there now. I don't have to worry about that. It's more about just playing.
What kind of, what kind of fitness and exercise do you do? I mean, what does a typical non-bowling practice week look like for you?
Yeah, so I'll go in the gym. Monday, I'll do my back and triceps, and then have a rest day. Wednesday, I'll do my chest and biceps. So now my body's ready for a beach body. I've done my thing, right? So I'm ready for that. If it's a nice hot day, so then I can wear my slinglets, right? On Thursday, because Thursday's a great night out in London. So I'll get that absolutely spot on. And then Friday mornings, I go do my leg sessions, which is legs, cores. And in between, I do a bit of a run. So I try and go 3-4 times a week and keep myself body fit. So as long as my body is fit, then I can keep playing. And there's a lot of players now in the Masters leagues are still playing, like 45, 50. So if you keep yourself fit, yeah, you can play as long as that.
Really? Who's the oldest person in cricket at the moment?
At the moment in these Masters, Misbah Ul Haq, who plays for Pakistan, I think he's 49. Mm-hmm. So he goes to me, look, I'm doing it at 49 and you're Monty 41. So I reckon you've got another 10 years of this.
And you'd like to have another 10 years at it?
Well, I did a Masters in sports journalism at St. Mary's University after England won the World Cup in 2019. I had my autobiography out. So I was doing my media career there, but it didn't really kick off. So then, you know, people around me, they just said to me, look, if you're serious about a career in the media, why don't you do a course? So then I did a master's at St. Mary's University. And
was that distance or actually?
No, actually on campus. And I really enjoyed journalism. And I remember writing my first article for the Sports Gazette. My lecturer, Dara Minogue, said to me, this was Black History Month. And he asked me a question. He goes, okay, I want you to write an article on the first black cricketer to play for England. And I go, oh, this is Devon Malcolm. He took 9 for 57 against South Africa. And then I did my research. He goes, no, it was Roland Butcher. So he goes, why don't you go and find him and interview him? So I interviewed him and asked about his career and everything like that. And then he talked about, oh, I would like a statue of the Jackson Five, which were five black cricketers that played in the 80s for Middlesex.
I'm thinking of the singers.
It shows how much I know. Yeah, but that's how they called them, Jackson Fives. It came from that. And then he never said that in the national newspaper. So suddenly I had a headline and I went to my lecturer. I said, look, he hasn't mentioned this in the national newspaper, but I've got this. He goes, yeah, print it out and let's see, you know, what traction we get. And that's when I got the taste for journalism, right? And I remember my lecturer saying to me, so he goes, Monty, why are you studying this course? I said, I want to become the Brown Piers Morgan of journalism. Because I love, you know, obviously Piers Morgan, he loves cricket. And I thought, I want to be controversial, polarize opinions, create debates, be a clickbait, create massive views, you know, all of that kind of stuff, like being a headline journalist, right? That's why I ended up doing it. So I'm still waiting to become that because I haven't hit any headlines yet and I haven't polarized opinions. But I think what Mike lecturer said, he goes, no, there's better journalists out there than him. Gosh, you know, he's just a, you know, obviously headliner, but, you know, there's some brilliant journalists. And then I started to go deeper into journalism and broadcasting. And that's the sort of career now I'm definitely heading towards because I always watch all different newses, different presenters, how they present and everything like that. So I really enjoy it.
And do you do much article writing and stuff?
I've got a column with the Daily Telegraph. So I write.
What's that? How often's that?
Yeah, like maybe every couple of weeks. If it's during the cricket season, once a week. Sometimes different stories.
Do they let you write about pretty much what you want or do they tend to give you a theme to go with?
I'd normally come up with the ideas. You know, my next one probably could be, you know, Matt Haycock Show, great podcaster. You know, get on the...
Saying all the right things, aren't you?
get on, pitch it to the business section and say, look, here, this is a great podcast, man, successful businessman, gone to Dubai now. And suddenly, you know, he's learning about cricket.
Well, talking podcast, you've got your own. Is having that part of, part of your quest into journalism, is it a bit of practice or something?
Yeah, because part of my project, I had to choose a project as well when I was at uni. So mine was to create a podcast. And then through the podcast, I learned how to maybe, you know, upload things, how to do Adobe Premiere Pro.
Oh, you're doing it all yourself?
Yeah, so sometimes I do it myself, but I would love to have a studio like this. This is brilliant, you know, this helps, doesn't it? You need a production team, you can't do it yourself. And how do you normally
meet people to do it, or do you do like Zoom interviews and stuff?
So yeah, either Zoom or sometimes I just do it on my phone, get the voice recording and then upload it on Podbeam. And then when I put it goes on Spotify, it goes on all the other platforms. So that's the way I've
It's such
do
a
it.
Different dynamic face to face. I mean, obviously, you know, the audio quality is better. But for me, it's not that. It's just the dynamic of being in the same room.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is where I need to take my podcast, really. I need to do it face to face, have a recording, put it on YouTube so people can watch it on there, as well as audio listening. So, you know, then you get the best of both worlds, don't you? So you've got it absolutely spot on. This is brilliant.
Well, look, we're going to go and we're going to dig into the financial aspects of cricket, but we'll have a little brief interlude by me telling you my cricket story. So I do remember hitting a few balls at school, you know, in the same way I'd, you know, kick a few balls or do whatever, but I was never particularly sporty at school in the slightest. And I used to play a lot of poker. And let's rewind to this must be 2009, 2010 probably. I was playing a poker game in Leeds and one of the guys who played with us played for, I'm going to say it's for Huddersfield. It was a Huddersfield house, but I'm pretty sure it's for Huddersfield. And he was just talking over the poker game one night, saying that they just had their sponsor pull out just before the beginning of the season, and it was gonna leave a big hole, potentially leave things in question. And he said to me, "Do you fancy sponsoring a cricket team?" It was a very surprise question to me. I says, can I play? He said, well, do you play cricket? I said, not picked up a bat since I was about 10 now. He goes, well, how can you play without, if you can't play cricket? I said, how can you play if you haven't got a sponsor? So I says, I'll sponsor you if I can come and join in a few games. And I just, you know, I was saying it for bants, really. You know, I thought I'm always up having a try at something. So he goes away and calls me back. He says, "Yes, you know, we'll get you in a few games if you can sponsor us." So I agree to sponsor. Anyway, it's going to be the first game of the season. It was some 2020 type thing. So he said, "Well, you need to come down for practice." So I've driven down to practice. And I can get out of the car, and they're in the nets, and I'm like, "Where's your stuff?" I'm like, "What stuff?" He's like, "Your bat, your pads." I ain't got fucking anything, mate, to be honest. So I'm like cobbling some pads off one guy and a box off another, and the bat. And I remember being stood in the nets, absolutely fucking petrified as someone's hurtling a ball down at me, which is probably still 50 miles an hour slower than it would be coming at me if it was coming from you. Managed to get my bat on a couple of balls, and it was the 2020 that weekend, so I've rocked up. I was with my ex-wife at the time. My ex-wife and my daughter was about 2 or 3 years old, and I've turned up in the changing rooms with about 7 bags of Marks and Spencers. You know, right, boys, I've got Colin the Caterpillar, got Percy Pigs. You know, and everyone's looking at me like, "Who the fuck is this idiot?" You know, like, thank God he's sponsored, otherwise he wouldn't be anywhere near us. And I played that game. Obviously did the fielding. I think we ended up, well, say we, me, ended up scoring six or seven or eight runs or something. You know, I didn't get knocked out straight away. And at the end of that game, I said, you know, I won't force you to make me play again. So I won't force you to play me again. You know, I'll leave you guys to win without me. But I've done my little bit to be able to say I played some cricket and didn't get knocked out with nil runs. So that was my that was my cricket experience.
Well, that's a good story, that. You know, maybe I'll get you to join my team, and then you can get your massive bag full of Marks and Spencers. I said, "Matt's great to have on our side. He brings all the sweets, Haribo.
A sponsor and I bring the sweets."
Exactly. You'll be perfect for us.
Look, let's talk about money in cricket. I get, you know, how financially motivated were you as a kid, and when, I guess, when you started to play, you know, was it all for the love of the game, or was it going to be a big amount of money compared to what you were used to as well as a kid?
Yeah, look, obviously when you're playing for England, it's the passion to represent your country, and then suddenly once you do really well, and the way I was obviously enjoying my cricket and the positive and the enthusiasm that came with the game, I obviously, you know, the whole public loved it. And then suddenly you're getting sponsorship deals, you're getting like, you know, Walkers, you know, had my own sort of flavour, Tuna and Lemon.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and, you know...
Your face on the bag and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, yeah, face on it. We're going to come out with this special, you know, just a Walkers crisp. And so that became, you know, crisp became quite a, you know, big sponsor there for me. I had Empower, back of the bat sticker, you know...
Just your bat or everybody's bat?
No, just my bat. Yeah, just my bat. And then ASICS was another sponsor.
And I guess, so away from you, just like cricket in general, I mean, what would a typical domestic cricketer be getting paid?
Well, now they get paid quite a bit. But I think generally you're looking at, let's say, you know, about 50,000 benchmark.
Okay,
not so, benchmark, but average, 50,000 to 60,000 maybe a year.
And then would they typically be trying to get some of their own sponsorships, or, you know, some local sponsorships?
They could get local sponsorships, local things, but generally speaking, it ranges from 30,000 to 80,000, or some people get 100, 120, the big guns.
But
averaging around 50,000 to 60,000, let's
say.
And
if you're playing for England, are there different wages for England as well, or is that the same?
No, to England, you're going into then, you know, 250, half a mil. You know, some people go up to a mil,
but it's wildly different. It's not like
So it's like, it's, you just go on to the next level depending on your sponsorships you get, whatever. So, you know.
Oh, sorry, you mean that the difference between the million and the 250 is someone who's got more sponsorships and things?
It's sponsorships included and everything, for the whole package.
But is the actual England wage, is that the same for everybody?
That changes. It's a different bracket. You know, so you get A grade, B grade, C grade, like that. But generally speaking, most of the guys are in the 250, half a mil bracket. And then the real X factors probably be mil, some 2 mil, whatever. And then since the introduction of IPL, you know, you're a piece of people like earning £1 million for 6 weeks.
Really?
You know, yeah. So if you play 10 years of that, you got 10 mil in the bank, right? It's easy maths. And then a bit of sponsorship could be 15 mil, whatever. So yeah, there's a lot of people who've just, since the IPL, they've just become multimillionaires.
When you were in your younger days of playing, did you have a backup plan? Did you think that, look, this money's not going to last forever, and it's not also going to be enough to let me retire on, so I'm going to need to do something after cricket?
Yeah, we always like that. Like you said, after cricket is then you're trying to reinvent yourself really as a second innings. And I often thought, what do I want to do? Do I want to go into the city? I tried working for a little bit for QuickBooks as a development officer, business development officer, and I went through it and I just thought, nah, this is just like, this is like too hard. Not too hard, I just didn't enjoy it. And then BlackRock was another one. I could have gone there, worked there, investment banking. But I just thought, I need to stay connected to cricket. I just didn't enjoy it. And then media entertainment. A lot of people said that you should be on TV. You should be working on TV. You got that sort of funny personality. There's something about you. There's something obviously different in terms of your character. because you have so much love for the game and the way you really bring out the energy in you, right? And that's what you should be doing. So then that's when everything aligned. I just thought, let's do a media degree. Let's do a master in sports journalism, and then gradually build my, through that, I had my own podcast, obviously a column, and then I do a lot of interviews now, on Sky, TalkSport, BBC. So I'm gradually just building up that profile as my broadcasting career now, yeah.
Have you done much investing over the years?
Yeah, I've always invested in property, government bonds and all that kind of stuff. And I've always been, investing for the future.
Anyone that you kind of take advice from, or whether it's financial advice, investing advice, anyone you've done business with?
Nothing yet. I'm waiting to do a massive deal with Peter Jones one day. You know what I mean? We'll get a block of flats, and then he helps me to renovate it, and then we get nice little money. Maybe that will happen one day.
And maybe jealousy is the wrong word, but it must, you see a sport like cricket, and obviously, like you say, since the IPL's come in, more money's in there. But, even so, some like the entire wages of some of these teams are less than 1 week's wage from a football player, or, as well, you see what's going on in Saudi with the football and stuff now. Is there a kind of an anger or competition in sport that, not enough money finds its way into cricket or into rugby, compared to football or F1 or whatever it may be?
Well, the thing is, 90% of these media companies like Sky Sports, Talk Sport, even the newspapers behind those pages, 90% of their sponsorship and money comes from football. So it's cricket isn't, or rugby isn't the big driver, it's a football. And amount of money that people are willing to pay, watch a football game of £100, £80 to £100, they'll go and watch a game of football. But cricket, you only get particular enthusiasts. So yeah, football, drives, I think, the economy much more than cricket or rugby would. So they deserve that level of money.
Well, let's take a bit of a change of angle and talk about, some more personal issues now. There was a time you were arrested outside the pub with your wife. I think you guys had a bust up. I think that ultimately led to a divorce and drinking.
Oh, no, I don't think that happened. Obviously, I think that's obviously a misinformation there, right? But that was just it was just sort of, I think at the time I was kind of not mature, if you know what I mean. You're not mature, you don't know.
How old were you at this time?
28.
Right.
Whatever. So, yeah, it was just a bad time for me at the time, that sort of time. And, you learn from, your mistakes, and you kind of think you want to move on, and, you mature with time, and I think now I'm in a much better place as a human being, know myself much better than maybe what I did when I was a 28-year-old.
I mean, do you think that event was caused from on-pitch pressures, that mental health issues that were maybe unrecognised?
Yeah, look, at the time I probably didn't realise the burden I was going through, the pressure of sport, whatever. And then later on, even my sort of family felt that, something isn't right with Monty, the way he's behaving. He's at that time I fell out of love with cricket. And I didn't realise, I felt at the time the fans around me who used to cheer for me are not with me. The umpires are purposely, not giving anything out. My teammates are dropping catches because they don't want me to succeed. But these were my own paranoid thoughts So when my confidence went down, I got very paranoid. And I remember then speaking, you know, to a cardiologist, Dr. Ball, who was, you know, understood this kind of symptoms, and he asked me to maybe go and see a help from a professional, you know, people in this industry, like a sports psychologist and stuff. And you know, they kind of like said to me, yeah, that's the kind of thing, you know, you have. It's like when your confidence goes down, you know, you get very paranoid. When it's nothing there, it's just in your mind, and it's your own thoughts. So then I did, you know, try medication for a little bit, but it made me put on weight.
What kind of medication?
Like antidepressants. And I got very sort of fat and, you know, didn't have any energy, didn't have no personality or anything like that. So I got off them. And then I remember going to Australia when I played grade cricket. And there the physio said, let's not do the medication, but let's have a checklist of things to make sure your mental state's in a really good place by just sort of... you know, is it exercise? If you don't feel great, do you talk, give someone a call? Do you read a book? Do you watch something funny? So like, you know, you got a little checklist because I'd rather you not take the medication. So then I just went through that and I just felt a lot better through it. And then now a lot of people ask me, how did you come over that? You know, a lot of people are still on medication and they want to get off it. I did it the holistic way. And, you know, like I don't know anything about my faith, to be honest, you know, as much as I know is like, you know, Sikhism and all that. But family said, why don't you just try and go to the, you know, Sikh temple and, you know, like voluntary work, you know, like what we have, like doing.
Were your family religious when you were a kid?
Well, yeah, they weren't obviously that religious, but they like to still connect it to the religion. They go, sometimes that's a nice way to not think about cricket is go there. And obviously I don't know much about my religion, but then I started to, you know, understand like, you know, Sikhism is also about a lot of voluntary work. You know, there's an open kitchen and then there's a lot of charities, you know, that go out and give food banks and all of that. So helping others, giving to others, I felt like, oh, that's really sort of helping me as well as, you know, helping other people. It's sort of helping me. So now I'm obviously got several charities I'm involved with, and I feel like that's another way of me just giving back what cricket gave to me. And you know, it's just, I think as human people, I think we get a lot from giving back, which we just don't realise.
And as well as the medication, did you start to drink at this time as well then, did you?
No, that time, like 2012 onwards, yeah, like my relationship with alcohol was to make myself better, and I didn't realise.
You'd always had a drink before, had you? Or did you?
Yeah, actually... no, I used to have the occasional, you know, drink here and there, but then when I wasn't great, I used to end up drinking a lot. And I didn't realise.
Well, just on your own or out with the boys?
Just out, you know, how you in cricket, you know, you win a game.
It must be.
Every time you win, everyone just wants to crack up a beer.
It seems a very drinky sport, you know.
Yeah, like, it's a very drinking, laddish culture. You're in the dressing room, you have one beer, one leads to 10. Next thing you know, you're catching the Uber home and on the way you're picking up a kebab, right? That's the way. Yep. You know, it is in cricket. And everyone's, the dressing room environment is like the brotherhood. It's like a real camaraderie we have. But there's times where you don't want to tell your teammate that, oh, actually, I don't feel that great. Or I'm not concentrating that well, or my focus isn't that good. Or you don't want to tell the coach that, because then you think the next game I'm not going to get picked. But instead you think, well, I'll just have a few drinks with the boys and we'll just have a great laugh. But inside you're not speaking about the emotion that's inside you. You're not telling anyone that.
When you started to talk to somebody about it and went on to the meds, was that when it first started? Was that public knowledge then? As in,
no,
or did your teammates know?
No, it happened. I had to Mike Atherton, who writes for the Times at the time, England captain. He interviewed me because everyone felt in cricket, Monty's gone off the rails. What's happened to him? You know, he used to love the game and now he completely just hates the game. And then I obviously explained this is what's going on because they wanted to know, but I wasn't opening it up. I remember there was a book that was sent to me by the PCS. Said, oh, you know, when you're strong, that's when you're trying to act the bravado and being strong is actually a sign of weakness. And you should, you know, I've read this book. I looked at it, I just put it in the bin. I was like, I wish I read it, you know, and I never threw it away. And then when I opened up about it, people began to understand and be sympathetic towards, right, there's something wrong with him. He needs to address his problem. And then obviously I addressed it, took a bit of medication, but I just didn't like the side effects. So started to then go the holistic approach which I think I find it much easier.
And how was your club? I mean, were they supportive?
Yeah, club was supportive at the time I was with Essex, and then they kind of like, you know, I went to the PCA, went to see, you know, they supported me through a sports psychologist, and all that had used to have regular sort of, you know, meetings with them and talk about stuff, and that I think helped. That helped a lot.
How's mental health in general in cricket? I mean, as I said to you earlier, you know, I've had quite a few sports people on lately, and you know, I guess with mental health being such a topical subject, you know, we tend to talk about it with most guests on most podcasts, and I think the footballers and the rugby guys talk about how much more probably visible and prevalent it is in those sports than it would have been, you know, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago. It's much more brushed under the carpet. I mean, has there been any particular events or changes you've seen in cricket?
Well, I think cricket, we've seen, you know, there's a lot more education available now. There's a lot more, the next teammate would look for signs if someone's not that great, or if, you know, everyone's playing an away game and then, you know, most of the guys are downstairs in the bar or having food together. Where's the other guy? Why isn't he here? Where has he gone? There's always that sort of checking up on each other. I think with the education from the PCA, that's really helped to understand what mental health is. It's like a broken mind you can't see, but when my arm's broken, I know in 6 weeks it will heal and there's a cast over it. You can see it, you understand it. But when your mind is broken, you can't see it, you know? And often it can be sugarcoated by many things. Food, alcohol's one. You can... you know, enjoy things. Some people like enjoy in general, you know, a lot of adrenaline that gives them. So they may end up doing like really hard physical training in the gym, do hard hit sessions. But you're getting the endorphins, but you're not talking about it. You know, what's really going on in your mind? You know, when a guy asks you, how are you doing? Now, actually, I want to know how you are. Yeah, I know business is going well. I know you've just bought another yacht. Or, you know, you've gone to the next, you know, VIP holiday event and you were, you know, rubbing shoulders with great people and it looks like you're having a great time. But really, how are you feeling at the moment? What are you really feeling? And then if someone can open out like that, they're the kind of conversations I think now men are having amongst men. It's easy with women, isn't it? Women, when they like talk, they'll say, oh yeah, guess what happened yesterday? I'll open up our can of beans. I'll put it in the microwave. And then I left it in there because I was ringing. I was on the phone. Next thing you know, the kettle was boiling. And then the beans were like, you know, they got overcooked. And then the baby was started crying. So these are the little chats that women talk about, but men don't do that. Men will always be very logical, A to B. Yeah, how's your day going? Yeah, really good. I got a meeting at 12. And then at 5 p.m., I leave for work. Can't wait for my gym session at 7. And that's it. But they won't talk about the little details like, oh, yeah, I got up this morning and, you know, got out of bed. And next thing you know, the dog was downstairs and he peed on the, you know, in the garden somewhere and had to take him out for a walk. But I tell you what, it was raining this morning. I was so annoyed. Couldn't get my, you know, work done or the emails done. So these are the little talks that men don't do often enough. And I encourage them to do so.
Well, let's move on to your autobiography. How long ago was that now?
2019, so yeah.
And what brought it about? I mean, did a publisher approach you to do it or did you fancy doing it at the time?
No, a publisher approached me. I was a little bit reluctant, but then I talked about it, and obviously there was only one title, The Full Monty. And yeah, I went for that and it was really well received. Yeah, very well received.
How long did it take you to write?
I think it took us about 6 months, you know, over the winter. Had five meetings.
And how was the process? You'd do meetings with a ghostwriter, would you? And relive stories to...
Yeah, exactly. Relive the stories and then, you know, just from there, really.
Was it a fun experience? I mean, did it make you remember things that you'd perhaps forgotten?
Yeah, there was times where maybe some certain cricket matches, which I didn't, you know, which I forgot and I didn't know about. That was really good. There was times where... you know, it's good to go through the whole journey just to make you understand the great times, the tougher moments, some of the fun times. So, yeah, it's brilliant.
I mean, did you have a particular angle yourself insofar as, did you want to get across some stories that would be inspirational for new cricketers and young people trying to make it up?
Yeah, like for me, I think especially, you know, just growing up, like, you know, people trying to, me becoming a cricketer, I think it was like you know, the way I played the game is they often say, right, how do you want to be remembered? You know, people forget your wickets and runs or goals scored or tries, and people forget that. It's how the fans remember you. You know, how did he play the game? And I think a lot of people say you just brought excitement, enthusiasm, joy. You was up for the challenge. And he goes, that's the kind of energy that people remember you by. So even now when I'm, let's say, walking down the street, if I'm in the tube, if I'm at a football game, wherever, there's still like a huge roar, you know, and like there's still a huge following, which I can only thank the fans, you know. Without their love and support, I wouldn't be here where I am today. Where I walk down the street tomorrow, just waiting for a bus, there'll be still people wanting autographs and photos. Or, yeah, well, I know you don't take the bus, but in London, we have to take the bus. It's a lot quicker, mate, trust me.
I'm choking on my Diet Coke, not the concept of having, having to take a bus.
Yeah.
let's touch on an important yet controversial topic, which is racism in sports. I mean, again, like I say, you know, with different sports people on, it's, you know, something we talk about regularly. In the little that I know about cricket, one thing I do know is one of my lawyers was actually chairman of Yorkshire Cricket Club or whatever it was when there was the big racism scandal up north. I mean, I don't know if maybe you want to touch on that story or tell me some other thoughts about, you know, about racism that is or isn't there. And I guess you will have either experienced it or seen it as a Sikh in English sport.
Yeah, like, look, I think that subject is really interesting because it's a complex subject, if you ask me. Like, since I did my degree in journalism, I got challenged, you know. I was asked by my lecturer. He goes, do you remember a boxer called Len Johnson? And I go, no, I don't remember him. He goes, in 1920, he was one of the best boxers in the world, but he could not fight for the British title because of the colour of his skin, because he was black and he couldn't play. He goes,
how? What year was that?
1920, so 100 years ago. So he goes, let's rewind. 100 years ago, you're a 1920, you're a left-arm spinner. You can't play for England because you're brown and you're not white. How do you feel about that? I said, yeah, I'll feel like, yeah, that. He goes, that's what discrimination is. Discrimination is where the colour of your skin, because of the colour of your skin, you can't, let's say, get into leadership positions, you have a glass ceiling, and that's it. But because you're, you know, it's not even colour of your skin, it's class, it's education, it's ageism, it's so many different things to it, right? From which school you're from which area you're from, the people that you know, suddenly you don't get it because the other person gets the jobs, the other person gets the work because his best mate is a CEO and his son is in there, you know, and that's how it works.
But do you think sometimes though people would cry racism for the sake of racism when the reality is it's just mates? Like, you know, you're up for a job and my best mate's up for a job. I give my best mate the job. Okay, it might be the wrong thing to do because you might have been the better thing, but I didn't give him it because he's white. I gave him it because he's my best mate. And then you start, like, oh, he's only done it because he's white. I mean, do you think that causes...
Yeah, that confusion can take place where you overplay that card, you know, the colour of the skin and all that kind of stuff. But I think now what's happening is the more people are calling it out and the more people are having a conversation about it, like now we're having a conversation about it, I think it's better. It gives you an idea that actually sometimes the racism that does exist can be sort of hidden, where they could be nice to you and say, yeah, you know, everything's great. But inside they know we're going to give the job to the other guy because, you know, for whatever reason, he's my mate or this and that, right? But even that is like, you know, discrimination. You know, if you're going to give your mate the job, but your other yes. candidate is better qualified, you should be giving it to the better qualified, not because he's your mate.
Absolutely.
But in life, it doesn't work like that. You know, sometimes when you're selecting a group of people to work in an organization, you always think about how will we get along as a team? Do we have a good laugh? Is it fun? You know, that also plays a part. So there's so many contributions. But when we talk about racism and obviously the Yorkshire stuff that happened.
What happened?
Well, I think, you know, Azim Rafiq, he obviously said that his career got shortened because of the colour of his skin. They would not pick him because of that, right? And then when I'm in London and speaking to some of my other mates, right, and these are like white British mates, they say to me, they go, going to Yorkshire, it's a different country. It's so different to the rest of the world, the rest of England. Yorkshire is just, you know, like, I think they had a rule that only after 1990, that if you are born in Yorkshire, then you can only play for the county. If you're born outside Yorkshire, you cannot play for the county. And they didn't have an overseas player either. But other counties were having overseas players in the 80s that were black, that were Indian. Northants in the 70s had that. So you can see that the other counties were probably easier to embrace diversity, embrace these things. But for Yorkshire, I think it took longer to understand that because they never allowed. They never allowed overseas players from the West Indies, from India, to play in Yorkshire. And I think if they did, then they would have understood other cultures. And they often say, you look at when England won the 2019 World Cup, Owen Morgan, Irish. Jofra Archer from Barbados. Adil Rashid, Pakistani. Moeen Ali, Pakistani. Jason Roy, South African. Chris Jordan, West Indian. That's diversity there. And they won the World Cup. And I think England is changing now. I think England is, there's less of the, let's say, people that they were in the 1950s, 1940s, how England was. You know, over time, I think times are changing. We never had Google, you know, 20 years ago. Now we've got, we're in the digital age. Now we've got apps on our phone. We never had Twitter. So I think with that, also culturally, things are changing. And I think often people see that a diverse organization is actually more profitable than maybe not being diverse. And I think now people are catching on that even if I don't understand diversity, if I say to you, you're going to be much more profitable, you're going to be better for your business, you know, with diverse training, people are willing to do that. But then there's still, you know, certain people, whatever ways their mindset is, they will probably say, no, you know, we're still in the 1940s and the 1950s. It's like, I want our organization to be only, you know, British white people. I don't want anyone else in there. And they won't say it openly, but you can see the evidence in the recruitment process. And then you're like, you know, you can't say nothing.
Have you personally experienced anything or been subject to anything over the years?
See, I was looking back to that. I sat down and I thought, have I ever got racially abused? And the answer was no. Because I loved cricket so much and I played for England. I was one of the main players, used to win games for my country, and the fans used to just love everything about the way I played cricket. They embraced that. So I remember an incident when during the Euros, I was in an underground. There was all just white people in there. A few, you know, that sort of, that look of the skinheads and everything like that. You think, geez, right, I do a bit of boxing. I better get ready, eh? It's going to be me and 20 others. Better be ready. Next thing, they're shouting, Monty, Monty, Panas are shouting and everything. We all started singing with them. And then I think my experiences of living up in England is probably not a fair representation of a British Asian guy coming through, you know, or, you know, Prince, you know, King Charles or, you know, or all the other great people, you know, the great people in this country. They all know who I am. You know, when I go into a room of VIP, everyone knows who Monty Panesar is. But that's not a reflection of a British Asian. They know everyone who they are. So when people come and talk to me about these issues, then I get an understanding. I'm like, yeah, you know, Lewis Hamilton, Anthony Joshua, Monty Panesar, they all know who they are. Everyone knows who they are. But that's not a fair representation. And sometimes you've got to also, since I've become a journalist and a broadcaster, you suddenly put that head on and you think, right, what is the real issue? What is racism really all about? What is it exactly all about? Why we keep talking about it? Why does it always come up in subjects? Why is it yet again, you know, there's another topic? And when you go into it, you kind of think, at times it can be overdone. At times it's, you know, it's spot on. And I think there is a change. I think organizations are saying, hang on a minute, we've got to just have a look at our organization. We may not be racist, but let's just see how many people are of a different background. And when it's not like that, then suddenly they start recruiting like that, you know, so they don't get accused of being in like a racist organization.
Well, look, change of topic. Let's talk about pilgrimage, the road to the Scottish Isles. I mean, how did that come about? And, you know, what was the experience like?
Yeah, look, I wanted to discover more about myself, finished my degree. They came, approached me. They go, do you want to go on this? We need, obviously, one from each religion. I had Sikh. And in Londonderry, there's a Sikh temple there. So they go, we're going to specifically record that program. And it was about St. Columba. So St. Patrick Day, we have St. Patrick. He's the most popular and the biggest saint from Ireland. But then after that, it's St. Columba. So what St. Columba did, he actually took Christianity to Scotland. And I don't want to bore you with all the details, but he went to the king in Scotland, and he obviously went to the king. He said, you know, at the time it was pagan Scotland, 1,500 years ago this was. And so he basically said then, he converted the king, converted everyone else, and he brought Christianity to Scotland. And as we went throughout his journey, all of us who were on the program, you know, Nick here from BBC Apprentice, then we had Lawrence Bowen,
yeah.
Yeah, he was there. He had a few things to say. I think he thinks he's Donald Trump, and I told him, you're not, right? but he's a great man, really fun guy. Then we had Shazia, there, Shazia Khan as well, the comedian. Scarlett as well was there, you know, from Googlebox.
Was that your first TV other than
No, I've done MasterChef, I've done Mastermind. But this was much more of a conversation between, you know, different faiths, but also amongst people about our conversation together. How do we feel about just life?
Well, what did you learn about yourself?
Well, what I learned, that all religions have a chant. So you go to the church, people sing hymns. You go to other sort of every, like even our, when I go to the Sikh temple, there's like the Kirtan, you know, which is our Gurbani that everyone, you know, listens to and they recite from that. And the same thing with the Hindu religions, the bhajans that they have singing. And then when we went to this one incident in Scotland where there's these stones, about 6 foot stones laid like that, one after the other, they said they were people, but they've gone, apparently they just froze like that. This was 5,000 years ago where they worshipped the sun and the earth and they used to do chanting. So what I learned is that every religion or every belief system has some sort of chant that they feel that they're chanting to something out there, which again is like an invisible force or universal energy or some positivity that we often chant to so we make our life positive. And that was really interesting for me.
I mean, do you think that all religions ultimately are 80% plus the same anyway? Okay, fine, you know, Jews can't eat pork and Muslims can't drink booze, but, you know, you take these little bits out of that. I mean, ultimately, you know, everybody's just teaching the same message of do good things, be a good person, and, you know, follow a leader, whoever that leader may be.
Yeah, like we often say in our Sikh religion, like our always Guru Nanak, they say, like, be a good human being first before practicing the religion deeply. And often we always talk about it, you know, love is God. If you love everyone, love your people, you're halfway there, right? By being a good human being. And I always believe, like, all religions are, you know, different rivers, but the water all goes to the ocean, doesn't it? So, and I think that's an easier understanding for me than going too deeply into it, because then I sort of get lost. But if you talk about cricket, then yeah, I understand everything about that.
Well, let's talk a bit about charity, the Felix Project. How did that come about? How long have you been involved in that?
Yeah, that has been a few years now, and they always get me involved. I do the big charity day, the trading day, and, you know, often earn a lot of money from that. That came about through LinkedIn. I had my LinkedIn account. They wanted to get in touch to see if you're interested. And I, you know, live locally in London as well. So it's a local charity, which is owned by the Evening Standard owner. And they raise about 8 million a year. And they still, I think, need to, if they really meet demands, they need another 5 million, to be honest, with some over 500, 600 organisations that still want, you know, Felix Project to supply them food.
Do you support any other charities?
Yeah, I've got the Muscular Dystrophy. I'm a supporter of that. And then also a Royal Marsden, Lord's Taverners.
And how have you picked them all? I mean, they're all very, very different, very different journeys or demographics to look after. What makes you make those decisions?
Yeah, I think they approached me again. They said, could you get involved in some of our events? There was a concert where Tom Jones sang with Royal Marsden. Then I do the walk every year from the Chelsea to Sutton, and we go through London. There's a bike ride as well, you know, with there. And then with the Muscular Dystrophy, I'm there during their big events, where they raise the big money there at Lord's. You know, they do the big Lord's dinner. So, yeah, I'm more involved with that. And so Racism Red Card as well. You know, they kind of approached me because maybe I just love football and I want to go to the Arsenal stadium, you know. I can go there and just wander around. I'm an Arsenal fan, so that's another reason why I'm there. But it's nice to be in different charities, and then you kind of like gives you a broader spectrum on how that, like as a country, I feel UK is really good when it comes to charities. We're very generous towards charitable, or you know, organisations compared to some of the other countries that I've been. So I think, you know, UK has got a really good system towards charities. And, you know, I obviously love giving back. And often I see, like, even being in the room, you can see how they say, look, just you being in the room, it raises, you know, we can get another 30, 40,000. And he goes, that what makes the difference. So I just try and give back as much as I can because I think it's really important.
Let's talk a bit about mentorship. I always like to talk about, you know, mentorship with all my guests because, I mean, you know, it's a concept that's obviously like very dear to me. I mean, people I've always been asked in my life, like, who are mentors of mine? And, you know, I always say that, I guess, you know, in my early 20s, you know, probably into my early 30s, I never really had people who I would formally consider a mentor. I mean, I always had the, let's say that whether it was the brains or the humility to, you know, to seek people to get some advice from, but it's really only the last 5, 6, 7 years that I've really, I guess, formally wanted to get into that concept of mentorship, you know, both mentoring me and me mentoring others. But talk to me about your mentorship through your life. Any particular mentors you've had that really stick out? Any particular lessons that you've learned? And do you now find yourself mentoring young sportsmen yourself?
Yeah, like growing up, I had my own mentor. You know, Deepak Barsooth. He passed away in 2015, and he really helped me. You know, with the concept of having a routine, having, you know, working hard, and just gave me a really good. I think at the end, he kind of said to me, look, I've given you all the tools now. Now it's up to you to use them. You know, I've given you everything that you need to learn about life and how to put it all together. Now you go and just, you know, chase it, chase your dreams, chase your goals. This was just before he obviously passed away. And I suppose, yeah, he was right. So he was hugely influential. Neil Burns was another one, played, you know, for Leicestershire and Somerset. And he had different ideas and concepts at the time. He was quite a good mentor. So yeah, I had a few mentors in my life. But now, obviously, you know, I need a business mentor and a media mentor as well, because I think it helps you, you know, if you're having these journeys. So I haven't really got, like, in that aspect, you know, mentors. Maybe, I don't know, maybe Matt could be my business mentor. And
you can teach me cricket.
Yeah, there you go. And make me into a multimillionaire. And next thing you know, we're on a private jet to Dubai and we're living it up. And
you
can tell everyone this was another guy, one of my success stories, one of many. I turned Monty into a multimillionaire.
You can give me a testimonial.
Yeah, exactly. I'll give you 10% of all my earnings, mate, if you make it to multimillionaire. Yeah, so in media, I've got a lot of media friends that I talk to, but not like all the time, because I think, you know, sometimes you have to learn as well, you know, by watching other people rather than constantly, you know, referring back to someone. You can get into a process of just reaching out for feedback all the time and not being in a position of, like, you make the judgment. You make the decision, because in the end, all the big, you know, like media guys, they end up just then they own it, don't they? They don't need any sort of then confirmation of, like, oh, they know they're doing it right. And you got to at some point get yourself there as well.
And what about you mentoring others? Have you got anyone now or along?
Yeah, like youngsters coming through, you know, either give them guidance or put them in the right direction, or in terms of cricket, you know, like, I've had a lot of British Asian youngsters coming to me and they go, can I get a trial? And next thing you know, they've been trying for the last 3 months. I can't get anywhere. I'll give a phone call. So there's that example, isn't it? Of, like, do I go for my best mate? And suddenly I'll give him a phone call. He goes, yeah, bring him next week, mate. All right, cheers, Monty. Have a look at him. And they go and do it. And they go, Monty, that helped me so much. You know, he got me through the system, accelerated it. We had a look. They've given us some feedback. At least I know what to do with the direction. So, yeah, like, I don't know. The world sometimes does work like that, you know. It's like the people.
I mean, the world totally works like that, doesn't it? I mean, the world's totally built up on relationships. But I guess when it comes to crime racism or something being a media or social media talking point, it just depends what colour those relationships are, doesn't it?
Yeah, true.
Well, ODI World Cup around the corner.
Yeah, look, England look strong, don't they? They've done really well against New Zealand.
I don't know, don't ask me.
Yeah, Matt doesn't know anything about cricket, but all our listeners do. And when it starts, on the 5th of October. I think England are one of the strongest sides, you know, going into the competition, and hopefully they will either get to the semi-finals. I think it'd be disappointing if they don't get to the semi-finals. Which I think is great to see in British sport, isn't it? Football, we're very strong. Rugby World Cup happening now. You know, they've done really well. So I follow all of the guys, and I have friends. I have friends who are playing in there. So that helps me to follow the sport as an excuse. So I'm good friends with Jamie George, you know, Rugby Union. You know, so I'm watching the Paris, and then instantly he does well. Send him a message. I'll get the message back. Their sort of personal relationships make it a lot easier. You know, in boxing as well. Go and see the guys. I can stay connected.
Which boxers are you friends with?
Yeah, Tyson Fury always gives me a call, doesn't he? He goes, Monty, man, you know, my jab isn't quite right. Can you? I'll send you a video of it. Can you tell me how it is? I said, no, it wasn't that good against Deontay Wilder, man. But, you know, you'll be all right. You'll be all right, you know, a fight against Anthony Joshua. But, you know, like Tony Bellew is, you know, quite a good friend of mine. Jamie Redknapp, you know, he's another good mate. You know, a few of the others. In terms of football, I need to find someone in football now, don't I? But I'm good with the Arsenal players because I love Arsenal, right? Paul Merson, Ray Parlour, all of them sort of guys, David Seaman. So, you know, the guys who I used to follow up, Ian Wright, you know, they're the guys, David James, you know, another one. But like someone you want in the England team right now, don't you? Maybe, you know, if I can get Harry Kane's number somehow and then just send him a message. Oh, that was a great goal, you know, for Bayern Munich, mate. You're doing really, really well. Do you know what I mean? So these kind of things, I like that kind of relationship because it helps me to stay connected to the sport, and then it helps me to then think, right, I'm watching them because I'm a mate, but also now I can then watch from a journalistic perspective as an excuse to stay connected.
We had Jimmy Floyd Hasselbank on the show a few weeks ago. He's I think, assistant coaching or sort of helping out with England in some way at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah, which is great. Gareth Southgate, it's been brilliant. I think it's a challenge now. If you're a national coach or if you're a big coach now in the Premiership, it's different. It's not like being the old gaffer and you can say whatever you want. It's like you got to also look at the wider audiences, you know, the fan following that you have as a club. You got to really embrace the diversity dialogue now. You know, you got to really bring in, have a coaching system, say, you know, have that question yourself like, okay, I know we could be all just brown people or black people or white people. Can we bring in something different? You know, Gareth Southgate is good like that. He does that. And I think it's good. I think it's healthy in society that we do bring in that.
Just back to the ODI, who are the players to watch?
Well, Superman of cricket, Ben Stokes. Obviously, he's a guy to definitely look out for. Moeen Ali, 100%. He'll be a big player for you if you can get... He needs a good World Cup because he bowls spin and spin takes in India. Abdul Rashid is another spinner. So the spinners, the countries who do well are going to have a good chance. So I think England need their spinners to fire in India.
Well, look, Monty, it's been an absolute pleasure having you here. I mean, you know, 20 plus years of story and careers, you know, even for a non-cricketer like myself, it's been fascinating to listen to. But I mean, if you had to look back on yourself now and think, you know, of all the things you've learnt and of all the advice you've picked up, you know, what would be the one single piece of advice that you'd give to 14-year-old Monty or even 10-year-old Monty with his first Centurion cricket bat?
Yeah, look, I wish I had a personal trainer. I know. It's, you know, everyone else would have a motto or something. I just think if you're a young sportsman growing up and you're not athletic, invest in a personal trainer. It would do wonders for your game. And I wish I did. I think I only got a personal trainer afterwards, but once I stopped playing. But if I had one then, I think I would have been such more athletic and I would have been great. I think that would have helped my sports a lot more. So any young sports, girls or boys growing up, get yourself a personal trainer because I think it'll just help your development as a sports person.
And basically whatever sport you're playing, you know, take the athleticism as seriously as the actual action of the sport.
Yeah, exactly. When we talked about skill, athleticism is a skill as well. You know, it's not just that's just a God-given, you know, talent you have. It's like, yeah, I think the sport has changed. You know, before it was skill about spin bowling, now being athletic is a skill as well.
Well, listen, Monty, it's been an absolute pleasure. And I look forward to following some cricket myself now. You've inspired me to do so. Thanks a lot for being here and hope we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, 100%. Thank you so much, you know, Matt, having me on here. And like it says business, money, life. Hopefully you create me a few more businesses, bring in a bit more money, and then we can have a great life.
And we should change it to business, money, life with a cricket in brackets at the end.
Absolutely.
All right, buddy. Thank you again.
Thanks a lot, mate.